It was a perfect Wisconsin morning, just before the sunrise, and I was running alone along roads bisected by rows of corn and empty fields of green grass. These fields are within sight of my apartment, but they feel like they are in the middle of nowhere. There are very few cars that travel out on those roads, especially early in the morning. So that's why I noticed the one that was sitting on the side of the road, its engine idling, its lights on. What was that car doing there, I wondered to myself. And I felt my heart rate increase, my breath becoming more shallow. I remembered the stories of three other women in different parts of the country who earlier this summer had gone out for a run in wooded areas not too far from their homes, and they never returned. Their bodies were found. Their killers presumably have not. I could turn right and take the long way home, or I could turn left and run past that car. The theme for this month is tell me a story about a time when you faced your fears. And this is a month that we typically think about fear because it's, you know, the light is lessening and the dark is growing and Halloween is coming, and Halloween is a tangible reminder of the things we're afraid of. And it's one way that children face their fears, by actualizing them. So if you're afraid of monsters, well, wear a costume. What about, you know, confronting your fear of zombies? Well, become one. Can't stand spiders, skulls, or snakes? Put them around your house. One of the hardest things about fear is that it is invisible. It lives in us and around us, but we can't actually see it. When we can make it visible, we have a better chance of naming it, confronting it, and ideally diminishing the powerful hold it can have on us. So this morning, I want to look at a couple of different fears, all of which I think are part of our human experience, and I want to look at the costs of fear, not only to our body, our mind, and our heart, but to our spirits. I stood at that crossroads, and I wondered if I should turn left or right. And as I was thinking about that, I instinctively reached into my pocket for a tiny can of pepper spray that I usually carry with me when I run. I had forgotten it. So I checked the other pocket for my Swiss Army knife that I usually carry with me when I run. I remembered it was sitting on the kitchen counter. One time as I was heading out for a run and my husband Wayne saw me pocketing the pepper spray, he was puzzled and said, "What do you need that for?" And I realized that we inhabited two different worlds. As a man, he could walk through the world with a certain degree of confidence that he would not be the object of sexist or degrading comments, catcalls, or unwanted sexual advances or assault. It never occurred to him that he could be the victim of sexual assault. And although I know some women who move through the world without this thought in the back of their mind, many women feel as I do, that I must be hyper-vigilant against what might happen simply because I inhabit a female body. It's a primal fear, I think. And this primal fear goes right down to our amygdala brain, that part of our brain that produces the fight or flight response. It's the kind of fear that Ta-Nehisi Coates describes so eloquently, in his case, the very real fear of the consequences of having a black body in white America. He describes the way that fear makes young men, turns young men into thugs, and hardens old women's natural softness, and turns a father into a belt beater. All consequences of fear. Having a black or brown body in this culture is the object of white fear. Having a queer or trans or woman's body in this culture means living with a certain amount of perpetual fear for personal safety. So what do we do to ensure our personal safety? We may go out and buy pepper spray or a gun. We may invest in security systems and live in neighborhoods that we believe are safe. We may take self-defense classes as a way of confronting and perhaps controlling our fears. Now, don't think that I am chiding you if you have done any of these, because I have done all of them, with the exception of buying a gun. Yet when the amygdala brain is constantly on alert for potential dangers, it tends to overshadow another reality of our daily lives, and that is the place where the things we fear rarely, if ever, happen. Back in the 80s, there was a rock group named the Talking Heads, and they sang a song that said, "Heaven, heaven is a place where nothing ever happens." And I used to hate that line, because I thought, you know, I don't want to live in a place where nothing ever happens. It seems so irredeemably boring. But now, as an adult, living in a world where crimes are reported on a daily basis, there is a great balm in the fact that for most of us, the fears that we may live with never actually come to pass. We get up. We drive to and from work or drive great distances. We arrive home safely at the end of our journey. We go to bed. We wake up the next morning without incident. We eat food that doesn't make us ill. We drink water that is clean, unless you live in Flint, Michigan. We drive cars that usually don't explode upon impact. Instead of waking up each day in gratitude for all the things that didn't happen, some of us may wake up with dread about what might happen. Such fear can be paralyzing. Should I turn left or right? Left would take me closer to that car that was idling in the lifting darkness. Right would force me to take the long way home. There was still no one around. I thought about how easy it would be to be grabbed into that car or dragged into the high cornfields. What about how much I still wanted to do with my life? I thought about how silly and irrational I was being. I decided that I didn't want my decision to be overwhelmed by fear. So I turned left and I started walking towards that car. When you look up phobias on the internet, that is all the things there are to be afraid of, it is an amazingly long list. And some of those make perfect sense to me, like acrophobia, fear of heights, algophobia, fear of pain, gerontophobia, fear of growing old, thanatophobia, fear of dying. These are all common and understandable fears, some of which we have control over, and such as avoiding heights when possible, and others, you know, we have no control over. We may be afraid of pain, old age, and death, but if you live long enough, you're going to experience all of the above. But there are other fears on that list that are puzzling to those of us who don't suffer from them, such as anthophobia, fear of flowers. Chrysophobia, fear of the color orange. And here's my own personal favorite, nomophobia, which is fear of being out of mobile phone contact. And then there's one that didn't make that long Wikipedia list, but it has its own page. It's called politicophobia, fear of politics and politicians. Now, whether or not you have a diagnosable political phobia, I think it is safe to say that fear has been a driving emotion in this most recent cycle leading up to the presidential election in November. And I suspect it's only going to get worse before it gets better, as fear is a powerful and apparently effective tool in garnering votes for one particular candidate or another. Now, we may feel that this year's election is the worst fear-mongering we have ever seen, but there have been other elections where fear as a campaign strategy worked. How many of you remember the famous Willie Horton ad, 1986, which was aimed at then-Governor Michael Dukakis by the George H.W. Bush campaign? And the purpose of that ad was to create fear in the minds of white American voters that a vote for Dukakis was a vote for a bleeding heart liberal who allowed convicted felons to go free on a weekend furlough and commit further crimes. It worked. It's arguable whether it changed the election, but there's no doubt that it inserted fear into voters' minds and that George H.W. Bush actually won that election. This year, I was struck by a quote by 2016 presidential candidate Jill Stein, who said, "This politics of fear has actually delivered everything we were afraid of." The current political climate, which holds up xenophobia, fear of the stranger, as fear of immigrants taking over jobs, fear of Muslims, many of whom are depicted as potential terrorists, fear of black and brown people, all of this is fed to a media that needs conflict to then feed our appetite for controversy. At the heart of all of this rhetoric is fear. Fear that what we have will currently be taken away, and fear that we will never be able to get all that we want. I have fears too, but they're not about having white privilege taken away or not being able to buy the things that I want. My fear has to do with what every nation has the potential to become, what my Urban Dictionary calls fearocracy, defined as governing through fear while posing as a democracy. We have plenty of examples of civilized nations descending into dictatorship because of the brilliant manipulation of people's fears. As Catherine Tollefson noted in her comments, the story of Wade Still and Martha Sharp risking their lives to save Jews and refugees in Nazi Germany. That film also depicts and offers a chilling reminder of how Hitler's campaign started with a promise and the hope of a better Germany and quickly descended into anti-Semitism and wholesale Holocaust. There is something in us that needs a scapegoat, and fear is the quickest way to identify and demonize the object of our fear. This past Thursday, I was invited to have a live on-air conversation at a radio station, WHBY 1150 AM, about the repeated theft of our Black Lives Matter banner. And one of the reporters asked me if the people of this congregation were afraid. And I tried to answer him honestly by saying, yes, I think some are afraid of what might happen. But what I see is that people are continuing to show up for racial justice. And then he asked me, well, what should we be doing? And what I said was something like, well, show up. Engage with communities that are working on issues of racism and white privilege. And because I couldn't resist the free advertising, I said, come to the fellowship. My underlying point was that one of the antidotes to fear is to engage with it, because the actual risk is actually far much less than what we imagine. I was getting closer to that car now. And as I looked harder, I saw two shadowy figures, one behind the steering wheel and the other one, who was taller, sitting in the passenger seat. And now the car had begun to move very slowly, inching along. I was this car going so slow, I wondered. And now there were two people in the car instead of one. And I could feel my fear rising again. I took a deep breath, and I approached the car on the other side of the street, as far away from it as I could. And as I looked across the road, I could clearly see the driver behind the steering wheel. To be alive is to live with fear. It was built into our DNA for good reason. It keeps us safe. If we had no fear of heights or wild animals, we wouldn't be alive for very long. So, of course, there is a healthy fear. We don't deliberately put ourselves in harm's way because we value our life and the life of other human beings. But there is an unhealthy side of fear, too. A kind of chronic tinnitus, fearful tinnitus, that inhabits and inhibits our ability to be fully present to the normal joys of life, which we take for granted. It's the fear that constantly whispers to us, yes, but this could happen. It's the kind of fear that insists on so much protection that we don't allow ourselves a bruised knee or a broken heart. It's the kind of fear that terrorists have used so effectively to make us turn our lives into a locked prison, not allowing our lives or our hearts be open to one another. The spiritual cost of living in constant fear is to become like a walking dead. Yeah. You're not really alive, but you have enough momentum and power, but you're not really dead either. What a terrible, terrible place to be. It's kind of a purgatory on earth, and one that I think would make for a truly dangerous world that we should be afraid to live in. I looked through the driver's window, and I saw the two hands gripping the top of the steering wheel. The driver was a teenage girl, and she looked utterly terrified. The shadowy figure next to her, her father, I presume, who was gesturing for her to move forward, to put her foot on the gas. And at that moment, she did so, and in a spurt, the car lurched forward and stopped, and I saw her put her head on the steering wheel. And her dad, looking alternately annoyed and sympathetic. And I remember my own first time behind the wheel of the car, and how when I put my foot on the gas, I felt this surge of both power and fear, and I thought, I could kill somebody. And I remember my dad sitting next to me, patiently telling me to just go easy, a little bit at a time, until you get the hang of it. That seemed like good advice for learning how to drive a car as well as for life. Just go easy, a little bit at a time, until you get the hang of it. As human beings, we may never get the hang of fear, but there are antidotes to help quell the anxiety. And that anxiety is part of our human condition. And I want to just briefly name a couple of those. One is to develop a spiritual practice. I meditate and pray on a daily basis. I'd love to say it's because I'm a spiritually enlightened being, but the truth of the matter is these practices help me counter the fears that I have as simply being a human being alive on this earth. The other spiritual practice is to engage. I am by nature a pretty deep introvert, so when thrown in a room of people I don't know well, I literally want to run. But what keeps me engaged is curiosity and thankfully a deep love of the human spirit. There are two opportunities for you to engage with a spiritual practice or with other people this month, and that's the Wellspring Wednesday program, both this week and next week. This week, Jennifer Levenhagen will show us how using art and music as a spiritual practice is a way of gracefully handling life's challenges. And the week after that, the Oshkosh folks are putting on a beautiful program about engaging with immigrants and hearing their stories and getting to know people on a one-on-one, face-to-face basis. And finally, the third antidote to fear is develop a deep and abiding trust in life itself, knowing that it is beyond our control. The end of our lives, what happens to us, is ultimately beyond our control. But what matters is, of course, how we live our lives now. The good news about fear is that we can be fearful together, or we can be courageous together. This summer, when the banner was stolen, and I decided to host a dedication of a new sign, I have to admit to you, I was afraid. I was less afraid of what would happen to me at that dedication, but for all of you. I was afraid that someone might try and hurt us, and if that happened and I survived, I don't think I could ever forgive myself. But when I saw so many of you coming with your children and your spouses and friends, and when one of you said to me, "Well, I guess if something was going to happen, I want to be with my people," I realized that I didn't have to be the courageous one alone, that we were going to do it together. And it's why we live in faith together and not in fear. And by faith, I mean that in which we can place our ultimate confidence and hope. For me, some days I call that place where I can place my ultimate confidence by the name of God. But on other days, God seems so far away, and I just need the reality of another human hand, another human heart, to hope me, to hope us, into acts of daring and boldness and courage. The Christian scriptures tell us that perfect love casts out fear, but our love, it need not be perfect. It just needs to be present. And when that happens, there is no room for anything else. Our fear may never be completely cast out, but we can crowd it into a corner by the ways we fill our lives with compassion and gratitude for all the gifts that we enjoy and share. May it be so.